It might feel as if the promised future is perpetually out of reach, but building Lightning is a lot like climbing a mountain. Climbers never really see the summit until they're standing on top of it. They often can't even see over the next ridge. Planning the ascent is important, but most of the time you're simply concentrating on the next foothold. But the steps add up. Just like the view from the top is the reward for all the effort, a brighter monetary future will be our reward for building the network, bit by bit. The best in Bitcoin made audible. I am Guy Swan, and this is Bitcoin Audible. What is up, guys? Welcome back to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know, and it only gets truer by the day, every day. Welcome to Bitcoin Audible, guys. This show is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin, the place to get on a Bitcoin standard in every way, the full financial suite for Bitcoin services, and then CoinKite and the Cold Card hardware wallet with all their freaking amazing hardware devices. CoinKite makes all the best security devices that you are looking for. If you haven't gotten a hardware wallet, freaking do it, Jesus, and get 10% off with code Bitcoin Audible. Links and details will be in the show notes. We've got a fun little read today, which is another one by Roy Scheinfeld, which we just had on the show, and I will have the link to our chat as well. But this one was a piece on offline payments with Lightning, and The article itself is pretty short, and it just kind of covers a couple of different technical ideas and then kind of a framework for how to think about offline payments. But also, he touches on a few points that we actually hit in the conversation that we had, but then he also hits them kind of more directly, maybe, if you say, in this article, that I think is a great way to frame where we are and what is happening. And I use, in the commentary afterward, in the guide stake, I kind of use this opportunity to take a step back and look at the big picture of things, because we want everything to be perfect. We want everyone to have full sovereignty. And one seeming idea or one conception of all of this is that it's like we all once had full sovereignty, like it was going to provide full and complete sovereignty for everybody in the world, but then it's like we lost it or it changed, and like now it's not living up to its promise, because as it turns out, scaling that is a very difficult thing. But I want to challenge that perspective. And I want to make an argument that the access, the value, and the degree of sovereignty that Bitcoin has granted anybody in its entire history has only gotten better. Like, it has only been more sovereign, even with people who can't hold their own UTXO today, even with people being like on Lightning as like your normal mode of operation for day-to-day expenditures. I genuinely think we have done nothing but move positive. We have done nothing but move in the right direction. And I want to make that case and why. And I actually think, even though this seems like just a simple little article about the, you know, some options for offline payments and how we might think about them going forward, Roy touches on another idea and a perspective that I think lends itself to a really important conversation that's more than just those specifics. But also, there's some fun stuff about offline payments with Lightning. So with that, let's go ahead and get into today's read. And it's titled, The Past, Present, and Future of Offline Payments, written by Roy Scheinfeld. Nobody is more critical of Lightning than its most passionate proponents. Guys like me, guys like Ben Carman. In a recent Stacker News post, he highlights liquidity and offline payments as aspects of Lightning that impede the UX and deter self-custody. This might seem like just another complaint about how the future isn't living up to its promise. We were promised flying cars, and all we got was the miracle of the internet. Everything is amazing, and nobody is happy. On closer inspection, though, Ben's got a point. I've been talking about the Lightning UX for years, including the challenge of offline payments. We even proposed a solution to the offline payment problem back in 2019. I'll explain below why we never implemented it. It might feel as if the promised future is perpetually out of reach, but building Lightning is a lot like climbing a mountain. Climbers never really see the summit until they're standing on top of it. They often can't even see over the next ridge. Planning the ascent is important, but most of the time you're simply concentrating on the next foothold. But the steps add up. Just like the view from the top is the reward for all that effort, a brighter monetary future will be our reward for building the network bit by bit. That's how Lightning has progressed from an idea to a functioning Bitcoin payment network, and it's how we will reach our destination. Since offline payments are a long-standing UX challenge, let me review where this problem comes from, what tech is currently available to deal with it, and what's on the horizon. I'll review Ben's other beef, channel liquidity, in a coming post. The problem. People who've only ever experienced fiat, on-chain Bitcoin, or custodial wallets might not even be aware that offline payments are a thing. Fiat and custodial wallets solve the problem by taking control of users' money. The bank or custodian receives funds or IOUs from other users' banks and custodians, and sends the funds or IOUs when users ask them to. If the user never actually has custody of the funds, it doesn't matter whether they're online or not. Only those who actually control the money need to be online. With on-chain Bitcoin, a sender needs only the recipient's address. Self-custodial Lightning is more challenging because both parties to a transaction need to be online simultaneously. The recipient needs to send an invoice to the sender. The sender needs to initiate the payment, and the recipient has to sign it. This arrangement restores users' control over their own money, but it can also be a pain in the user experience. The past, trials and errors. There were 11 recorded attempts to climb Mount Everest before Norgay and Hillary finally succeeded. Breeze's first attempt to crack offline payments was called Connect to Pay, which prompted the sender to notify the recipient when a payment was about to go through, so the recipient would open their Lightning app. The underlying UX idea was analogous to a phone call. Just get both parties occupied with the same thing simultaneously. But the ability to receive payments without conscious effort is simply too ingrained. It's the UX we all expect, and nothing less will do. People don't even like phone calls. They sing songs about it. Our next idea, which we called Lightning Rod, was more sophisticated. The idea was to use HODL invoices to let a routing node between the sender and the recipient intercept the payment until the recipient became available. Therefore, it was a lot like Zeus's ZapLocker idea. Although Lightning Rod works, we never put it into production because HODL invoices don't scale for routing nodes. They tie up funds. When a routing node holds a transaction, it's basically extending an interest-free loan to the recipient. Liquidity must flow. Solving the problem of async payments by freezing them en route just aggravates the liquidity problem. We were on the right mountain, but taking the wrong lines up. The present. Existing means to support offline payments. The good news is that technologies have evolved to deal with offline payments. No existing approach is a perfect solution in that they all have trade-offs, but each is useful in different ways. LNURL withdrawal. The first is LNURL withdrawal. Recipients can scan a QR code or enter a URL that instructs their app to request funds from a sender. For example, a user who wants to withdraw funds from an exchange can, quote, pull their funds at their convenience instead of the exchange pushing while they are offline. There are two major drawbacks with this approach. First, it requires the sender to have a node running on a server that's perpetually online, so it's inappropriate for non-custodial mobile or web clients. Second, the, quote, pull model only applies to very specific use cases, when users know they have funds to redeem. For example, it would be hard to spontaneously tip someone. The Breeze SDK approach. Leverage mobile notifications. Mobile notifications are another means to support offline payments. Triggering a mobile notification in iOS or Android can even give the client app enough time on the CPU to receive the payment. Using mobile notifications to process incoming payments doesn't require active involvement from the recipient and provides a natural, non-intrusive solution to the simultaneity problem. That's why we've included a new feature in the Breeze SDK to facilitate offline payments using push notifications. It's a major UX improvement for SDK users, requiring just a little work from developers. The Breeze SDK approach works like this. First, the devs create a webhook that an LSP can call when a payment is en route. As soon as the payment hits the LSP, as the last hop before the recipient, the LSP calls a Notification Delivery Service, or NDS, via webhook, and the NDS sends a push notification to the user's phone with instructions. It requires a little legwork on the developer's part in the form of setting up an NDS, but the result is a much better UX because users don't need to keep the app in the foreground to receive payments. It also enables mobile users to receive payments using a static address, for example, a Lightning address, LNURL Pay, or Bolt 12. Mobile notifications are an improvement but not a cure-all. They only work on mobile devices, obviously, and this approach won't work if the device is off or the user has disabled the notifications required. Moreover, Google or Apple could negate its effectiveness by changing how their operating systems handle notifications. That's why we need a solution built into the Lightning protocol. The future: building async payments into Lightning. The idea behind the next phase of offline payments is simple. Make payments asynchronous. Since the simultaneity problem affects self-custodied mobile and web users most acutely, and practically all such users connect to Lightning through LSPs, why not leverage their always online LSPs to synchronize the payment when the sender or receiver are offline? LSPs can decompose the payment flow in time by intercepting HTLCs, which eliminates the simultaneity problem, or rather, shifts it to the level of LSPs for whom it is no problem. It all starts with a message embedded in the invoice indicating that the recipient is offline but connected to an LSP. The sender sends the payment with a message to their own LSP to hold it with a long expiry time pending further instructions. The sender then messages the recipient's LSP, asking it to alert their own LSP, who is still holding the payment, when the recipient is back online. When the recipient comes back online, their LSP signals the sender's LSP to forward the payment. This model doesn't compromise the overall liquidity of the network because the only node where the funds can be frozen is the sender's own LSP, which is what the user actually wants. As simple as it sounds, this approach requires more tech to work optimally. Static invoices, onion messages, blinded routes, trampoline payments, and eventually PTLC. It's complicated, but those who want to dig deeper can watch my Honey Badger 2023 session. While some Lightning implementations already support some of these features, it will take some time before the entire network adopts them, which is crucial for interoperability. When will the future arrive? Of course, the sun will always rise tomorrow, but it's already shining today. My point is that we already have different functional ways of handling offline payments on Lightning without relinquishing custody, each suited to a different use case. LNURL withdrawal already works for some commercial contexts, and the new Breeze SDK feature enables offline payments for mobile devices. That's cool. We didn't always have that, but now we do. We're already living in yesterday's future. A protocol-based solution remains a work in progress. Many implementations like Eclair, LDK, LNDK, and Core Lightning, yes, I'm looking at you, LND, are making progress on the features required to make it happen. When implemented, async payments will represent a huge user experience improvement. It's a future worth pursuing. When we get there, I am sure there will be other challenges on the horizon, demanding our attention and testing our patience. But let's never forget how high we've climbed already. This episode is brought to you by Swan Bitcoin. Swan has everything that you need to either get started from zero or to live entirely on a Bitcoin standard. It is the full financial suite of Bitcoin-related services. If you're just getting started, it's the place to buy Bitcoin. If you want to set up an auto DCA, a way to automatically purchase Bitcoin slowly over time so that you can just accumulate $10 a day, $10 a week, $10 a month, $100 a week, $1,000 a month, whatever it is that you have that you can allocate, that you want to put into savings and have a long-term savings plan, you can set it up automatically and it will just run. It is the best way and the right mindset for investing in Bitcoin. And of course, you can just smash buy up to $10 million if you want to just get in. If you're looking for knowledge, if you're looking for a helping hand to get a white glove service for, you know, your high net worth individuals out there, if you're looking for why the market analytics, the value case, the reasons for this, and how to think about your strategy in a Bitcoin-only way, you want to get your business involved, you want to get your IRA and get your retirement tax-free allocated to Bitcoin, every bit of it can be found at Swan Bitcoin. Check them out. My link is right there in the show notes, swanbitcoin.com/guy. Check out Swan and get yourself on a Bitcoin standard. All right, this was a short and sweet article just exploring the offline payment space and also understanding the I think it lends itself to some interesting insights on the user experience and obviously extends the conversation that we had with Rethinking Lightning, which is the Stacker News article that he references to by Ben Carman. And one thing that we actually got into with our conversation with Roy on the show very recently, and also that I want to reemphasize here, is how far we've come. And you know, I think there is this expectation, because Bitcoin was able to give us this sense of full sovereignty, right? Like the power of Bitcoin's ability to give sovereignty to the people who were able to adopt it when the network, before the network had to scale. I think it lends itself to people getting mad and being frustrated with the fact that that expectation has to change when the network grows, that it cannot present that degree of sovereignty to everyone. But here's the interesting, here's what I think is the proper framing to think about this, because there is explicitly a trade-off. Like everybody who thinks that they're getting it some other way or that you're just going to like increase the block size fails to recognize the critical characteristics that have to go into it ahead of time, like that have to be there in order for that self-sovereignty to be meaningful. All you do when you're just aggressively, you're just hard forking the network constantly, or you're just increasing the block size basically without bound or really in any large fashion where running a node or recovering from lost nodes due to some network attack, or where you've got, you know, a gigabyte, 2 gigabytes per day being able to be added to the network, something that would just get out of hand insanely quickly to the point that you couldn't actually add new nodes to the network, you dilute that sovereignty. You do not add to it. You do not expand it to more people. You destroy the underlying sovereignty that you have to split up. So what you actually do is get the worst of both worlds, because you undermine the very foundation. You thin out the very service that it's able to provide, because the ability for more and more people to run nodes, the ability to fully and completely and provably verify this thing, no matter where you are in the world, and with as small amount of computation and storage and network access as you possibly can, that is the value. That is the reason the consensus matters. It's not a consensus technology if people aren't checking their own version of consensus. So if you're not running a full node, then it's not then the consensus is shallow. So it's important to remember that any of the proposed solutions that people claim is going to fix this or going to scale this to X amount of people are themselves just a shallow equating of oh, if you hold a UTXO in this new system with these new characteristics and all these changes we're going to make, well, then it means the same thing if you hold a UTXO in the system as it currently is. And that is not true. That is, it is equating two different things with two different degrees of sovereignty and two different characteristics. And there's also an argument to be made that the sovereignty in Bitcoin is actually getting cheaper over time, even though it's becoming less accessible in one sense, when you think about it in the context of like fewer and fewer people can actually hold their own UTXOs, fewer and fewer people can, you know, stash their stuff into their keys. You know, if you've got $10, $20 in Bitcoin, it does not make any sense to go on chain with this. You know, it becomes increasingly difficult and increasingly expensive for that amount of value to flow on the base layer. But here's the thing, is that when you can exchange that amount, when you can actually exchange $10 worth on chain because, you know, the fee's a penny, well, then that essentially necessitates a completely different dynamic in the mining profile of the system itself. Like, the reason, these things go hand in hand. The greater the security in the mining force field around the historical, you know, the historical data in the chain, the ownership of, you know, your UTXO is economically proportional to the amount of mining power that has defended your transaction. So even though it appears that because, you know, let's say when there's 1,000 people, 10,000 people using Bitcoin back in 2012 or, you know, whatever it was, it may seem like they all have the greatest sovereignty that there ever was. That they have profound sovereignty, they have low fees, they have all of this stuff, except that any of Google's, you know, GPU farms for hosting and supercomputers could have attacked the network and made a massive amount of damage, could have undone 6 months worth of activity if they had devoted, you know, 3 months worth of all of their supercomputer power or, you know, one major instance of their supercomputer to the network. Because I think it was 2012 that we just switched, like it was somewhere in there that we switched to FPGAs as the more common mode, like from GPUs to FPGAs, or at least we were in that transition. And the first ASIC computer didn't really show up until 2013. So mining power was very small, and it was literally, you only had the degree of sovereignty that you had because the value was small. There was no reason, the incentive to attack it was actually really low. But you are orders of magnitude so much more sovereign today by holding a UTXO than you were in 2012, even though it appeared that you had far more control, far more openness, and everybody, quote unquote, who was in Bitcoin could easily have their own UTXO. They had thousands of UTXOs, and it would cost essentially nothing to send a transaction. And as this network gets bigger and bigger, remember, the sovereignty is a degree of what you're comparing it to. The sovereignty and the protection and economic incentives of the Bitcoin network are directly tied to the economic incentives of its supposed attackers. So as it gets more and more important and more intertwined with the global financial markets and the global political and monetary systems, what you're actually going to see is that the adversaries, the potential adversaries, get bigger and bigger as well. Like, we're entering a phase where massive, you know, Western, like empire level governments, the United States government, China, the Chinese Communist Party, you know, the Euro powers, Russia, whatever, like, these are now our potential enemies. And as they become tied to and or involved in the network, and I don't mean that like, oh, they're going to hire some developers and start working on Bitcoin. I mean in the sense that they are investing, that their economies begin investing in it, that their stock market health becomes tied to investment and trust in the Bitcoin system, that you're seeing more and more, like the ETFs are the introduction of the Bitcoin investment thesis into the U.S. stock market. With that also comes the profound widening of the number of actors and the variant type and persuasion of the actors that are now invested in, that are now incentivized to protect and to be involved with this in some form or fashion. That is going to increase the sovereignty a lot. It is a lot easier for, let's say, the United States government to attack a network that is just, you know, on the Silk Road and is in this dark web, weird internet money phase, than it is to openly and aggressively attack something that has 13 ETFs on the broader U.S. market and has trillions of dollars invested in it. It becomes a far, far, far more difficult political situation to actually engage in, especially when it's mostly younger voters who are invested in this, and they specifically have to appeal to get any sort of the social winds towards their favor. So as this thing gets bigger and more intertwined with all of the global and monetary financial markets, that sovereignty, despite the fact that it's growing more expensive in fees, despite the fact that it seems quote-unquote more out of reach for people to have their own UTXO, I think you have an interesting situation where the sovereignty of a Lightning channel today that is even a shared always online instance may be comparable or even greater than the sovereignty of a basic UTXO on-chain with your keys and everything back in 2011. Like, how large of an actor and how involved do they have to be if you're running your own node and you chose who you open your Lightning channels with, and you know, you have your situation, you have your information about this, and you can enforce it on chain. Like, what is the difficulty of someone attacking and trying to take those coins from you or from anyone in particular? That's the other thing, is that, like, you know, you have to be specifically targeted, very much in the same way that you'd have to be specifically targeted back in 2011 or something on the Bitcoin network, that specifically they want to reverse your transaction and that it won't just show back up in the mempool after they, you know, reorged a bunch of blocks or something. So I think there is an argument to be made that sovereignty, even as it is scaling to more people and is seemingly out of reach in certain regards, like certain types of, like, the mechanical pieces of exactly what you're doing to get that sovereignty, is still actually getting cheaper. Not because it's getting easier to hold a UTXO, even though it is from a technical and practical sense, all the tools are infinitely better than they were in 2013. I mean, shit, now we have time locks and multi-sig and, you know, key sharing and financial services that give you freaking dollar loans where you can actually still hold one of the keys and see the coins explicitly on chain and address. Like all of this stuff is crazy. So not only is it getting better in a practical sense, but also the degree of sovereignty is growing at an incredible pace, because that sovereignty is directly reliant on both the value, the infrastructure, the degree and variety of people, of countries, of political instances and jurisdictions that are involved and or invested in this, the size and maturation of the mining market, of the mining infrastructure. All of these things are growing massively, and all of these things reinforce the economics, the economic incentives, and build a stronger force field around the history of Bitcoin. If you think about it, like right now, somebody like my Watts miner that is heating my house, I could probably mine and reverse all of the transactions from 2009 to 2011 in the chain. I could rehash the entire block for 2 years in a really short amount of time. I don't know what it would be, but I'm pretty sure like my Watts miner itself could have 51% attacked the network back then. I mean, maybe not. I'm not 100% sure. I'd have to dig into it. It's interesting because I could probably just get a block. How would you go about that? I could get a block hash, and just look at the preceding zeros. How would you do that math? That's interesting. That might be a fun project to just like screw around with AI if I ever have time, which I never have time to do anything. But that would be a fun one, is to figure out how to estimate the amount of hash power on the Bitcoin network just from the preceding zeros on the block hash on the Coinbase that signifies the difficulty, you know, how much the difficulty adjustment is set at. There'd have to be a way to do that. Of course, that'd probably be totally overkill. There's probably just a chart with the Historical. Actually, let me just look it up real quick. I'm curious. 2011 mining hash rate. Let's just see what happens. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Right here. In 2011, with the FPGA mining machines, started a new era. The Bitcoin hash rate, the whole Bitcoin hash rate rose from 116 gigahashes at the beginning of the year to nearly 30 terahashes per second at the end of the year, a nearly 300x growth in a single year for the Bitcoin hash rate. Holy crap. I could trounce with just by heating my house, I could demolish the network. One of my miners does 70 terahashes per second on the low setting and about 90 on normal settings. So when I have both of them running, it's somewhere between like a 150 and 180 terahashes per second, which is six times what the entire network was producing back in 2011. So that is what I mean when I say sovereignty has gotten better, even though fewer people can hold their own UTXOs. Because how safe was a UTXO really back in 2011? So all of that tangent is just to say, we've come a really, really long way, and there may actually be an argument that the sovereignty of Bitcoin is actually getting cheaper, because the degree to which scaling is forcing us into trade-offs is also creating such a more profound degree of security and economic alignment in the Bitcoin system that the system as a whole is just that much more secure and that much more defensible from even massive attackers and malicious actors. So back to the point that Roy brought up that I think it's important to recognize is not what we have failed to achieve, or not that, you know, we haven't created some fantastical future in which everyone can hold their UTXO, everybody has the most profound and deeply, like, incomparably valuable degree of sovereignty for everyone in the entire world without intermediaries, without any trade-offs of any sort in any way, shape, or form. Sure, that doesn't exist right now, and the whole world can't do that, but it never existed. It's important to remember that our fantasy is not reality. Bitcoin could never do that. None of these systems can do that. The only ones that even pretend to, by just equating what they say is the thing that gives sovereignty with Bitcoins, do so by just thinning out the sovereignty. That they don't actually solve the problem, they just thin it out so that on the surface, it's like saying that, you know, you can feed more people a piece of pizza. You know, this one pizza is going to provide food for a whole lot more people if we just cut it in thinner slices. Yeah, sure. You look at you. You only have one cup of, like, really good high-quality coffee. But here I am feeding coffee to 200 people. You suck. I'm 200 times better. But then you see what they're drinking, and it's just, like, horribly thin. It's basically just like water with like a little bit of discoloration, and it just looks gross, and it doesn't even smell like coffee. It's critical to understand that distinction, and also that Lightning has provided a degree of scaling and new potential for payments that practically nothing else can compare to. And it seems rather undoubted at this point that the incredible investment and growth of the Lightning Network that is going to be the integral, it is 100% going to be the web that connects all of the quote-unquote second layers, all of the services, all of the new custodial, non-custodial, semi-custodial, all of the various tools and payment apparatuses that will show up in this system to help scale this again to more and more people. And remember that also scaling sovereignty is also about you being able to select who you trust and you being able to permissionlessly compete in that environment. Like, I think the permissionlessness of Bitcoin alone from a global perspective is basically all that's needed. It's all that's needed because we're going to have these fights. We're going to argue about how it is to scale this thing, and we're going to be able to build and test anything that we want. Like, freedom is explicitly messy. It is explicitly full of disagreement, full of conflict, full of uncomfort. Why? Because we allow the uncomfort and the disagreement and the conflict to happen at a small scale so that it doesn't grow to a massive scale that requires staggering amounts of violence and destruction in order to clean it out. You take the conflict, you take the stimulus and the entropy in small bursts, and you react locally to it. So one of the things that makes Bitcoin potently powerful, even in a custodial environment, to be able to provide more sovereignty is that you get to select who you trust. Right now, when I select who I trust, when it comes to the fiat system, I select between three different banks in my areas, of which I trust none. I don't trust any of them. They're all full of shit. They're all insolvent. I have no relationship to them. I've got a banker that doesn't know me, doesn't care about me. I'm just a number in their spreadsheet. And if I called up the CEO, he wouldn't give a flying he would just be like, I've just got a scammer call and I'm just going to hang up. If I give him my problem that somebody stole $100,000 from me through his bank, he doesn't care. He doesn't care. I don't get service. He may have been the one who stole it. They may have been the one who froze my account because I posted the wrong thing on Twitter. My being able to select BTC Sessions or Cali BTC or Ben the Carman to be my financial institution, to be my LSP, to be my eCash provider, to be my troubleshooting help. My being able to select who I trust from a pool of anyone in the world, that is a degree of sovereignty. None of this is white and black. None of this is cut and dry. The entire thing is a spectrum. It's a giant gray area. And I think what we constantly do is criticize the fact that we've never reached a fantasy world that has never existed and completely fail to even appreciate the insane amount of progress that we have made. There will not be an end to scaling. There will not be a switch that turns on and off or just undeniably completes the trust problem. The trust problem is something that is necessarily comparable. Like it is, it's relative. It's relative. It's just like gravity or weight or value or anything like this. It only makes sense in comparison to something else, to an attack vector, to a way that something is lost. So I think it's important to remember to hold the perspective in our minds that there was not a past where everyone had full, incontestable, just insane, fully complete sovereignty, and now we're losing that. That's not true. All we have done is increase and expand the amount of sovereignty that is available and the number of people who can take advantage of it. It has done nothing but get better. As Roy says in this article, we are already living in yesterday's future. And like I said, there will not be a finish line on this. We will constantly get incrementally better. And maybe in 10 years, 20 years, who knows, there will be another fundamental breakthrough, maybe a cryptography breakthrough, maybe another unbelievable protocol improvement that just completes the thing that Lightning was trying to be, or a perfect layer two that completely changes the architecture or rethinks how we utilize Bitcoin's consensus mechanism to create transactions. Maybe an entirely different way to think about transactions that are somehow sub-UTXO altogether. We have no idea. We do not know what is possible. We just started. We just opened the door on this. I mean, think about where we were with the internet 15 years into TCP/IP. The idea of getting everybody connected and the idea of having a device in everybody's pocket that could do anything, that could access anything, you could order whatever the hell you wanted from anybody, where you could communicate with millions of people in an instant. Like, that was absurd. It was a pipe dream. And then in thinking about Bitcoin's history and what had to happen in order for Bitcoin to even exist, we worked for 30 years building all of the pieces. I mean, hell, you could go back all the way to the early 1900s if you really wanted to, but all of the different pieces in the digital realm, in the kind of internet age that were needed to be advanced and to be developed in order to make Bitcoin possible as the culmination of all of those pieces, it really couldn't have been done any faster. And when we get a scaling solution that does expand and improve the value and degree of sovereignty to that many more people all around the world, when we do finally get that, it is going to, in hindsight, be obvious that we couldn't have done it any earlier. So I just want to make that clear, that I think the goal, this perceived, this hopeful future where the whole world can be sovereign in the digital age, is not something that we had in Bitcoin at the beginning and then suddenly we lost it and now we should be pissed. It is literally something that we are closer to today than we ever have been in Bitcoin's history, because it's just getting better and better as time goes on, and it's a never-ending project. We're just going to keep incrementally making it better, and there will be stair-step, like step function improvements over time after, you know, 5-10 years. And who knows, with the way things are accelerating and moving now, that step function improvement might come this year, might be in 2 years. Who the hell knows? But we are going closer. Nothing is doing anything but getting better, and the sovereignty is doing nothing but growing and becoming more accessible to more people in more ways. And, you know, even in the context of just Lightning, because what Roy talks about in this piece is really just about Lightning-based offline payments. When one of the really cool things is with something like eCash is that you can exchange eCash entirely offline. I mean, obviously the simple version of the eCash setup is custodial, but it's also a powerful privacy tool and payment tool, and you can exchange it entirely offline because the signing of the keys is the proof of payment, essentially. So when you are shifting eCash from your person to the other person, as long as you can connect with them, or you know what you're signing off to, I believe, which eCash is actually something that I should really do a deep dive on that, because how it works is what I know about it is actually pretty shallow, but it is fascinating from so many different perspectives. And we covered the eCash history recently with DigiCrash and the article that happened just after DigiCash was, like way back from the 90s. Such a good article. I'll actually try to remember to have the link in the show notes. In fact, I'm going to put it down now so I don't forget. But eCash would definitely be something worth diving into in kind of a technical deep dive episode. And I know not everybody can follow along with those, but I try to make it as simple as possible, or at least as simple as I can understand it and make sense of it myself. But I think those are also really, really critical so that we understand, like for myself in particular, just to understand where, you know, there is hype around, oh, it can do this thing or it can't do that thing. And you know, so often there's nuance around both. It's like, okay, yeah, sure, you could do this, but it actually adds like a lot of complexity and it's not a simple setup. And yes, it can't do this, but it's not quite so simple. You can actually kind of emulate this other thing. And honestly, something like eCash, if anybody listened to the episode about this, what was it, SpiderNet or Spider something? It was about a crazy, like, kind of convoluted, but actually really, really fascinating way to do a form of proof of stake on top of Bitcoin. And it actually didn't require, I don't think it required any, like, major changes. If it wasn't something simple, maybe CTV. No, I think it was almost, like, soft fork free, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know. I'll try to find that one and put that link in the show notes. I need to refresh that one. I need to listen to SpiderNet, whatever the hell that was called. But it would be interesting to see something like that utilized eCash so that you kind of had an ongoing sort of ephemeral federation, so to speak. Like, that was kind of the interesting thing about SpiderNet, is that you didn't know who had any control over it at any one point. So it was kind of like this, it was an attempt at creating proof of stake on top of Bitcoin using proof of work as the consensus mechanism. And I think it was actually a Jameson Lopp piece. I think Lopp is the one who broke it down. But I don't know. I don't remember that one well enough, but it was at least a really, really interesting proposal. And it's something where if you could create a semi-custodial, a trust-minimized situation in which you ran eCash on top of it, you could start to get into really, really interesting dynamics. And also, you have this, you already have this liquidity built in this interlocking or this this kind of internet, this lightning network that is kind of the internet between all of these custodians and federations and other layer twos and channel pools, et cetera, et cetera. Like lightning becomes the liquidity network to settle payments between all of them. And then Bitcoin is the base layer that is essentially the ultimate final settlement that gives you just unheard of, like incomparable security and sovereignty over ownership at the end of the day. It's the final court that basically settles all disputes. But it is interesting. I haven't even talked about the article so much as like a lot of the implications of the article. But LNURL, for anybody who's used it, is a really interesting thing because you're basically giving the keys to make a pull transaction and with an explicit amount, which is really cool because you can essentially just keep it and then have it for whenever you need to pull the payment. Like you don't have to, you have the piece of information so that whenever you come online, you can pull the payment. Like an example that uses that is Fountain. Fountain.fm, the Fountain app, this is like my main podcast app now. They do, when you are doing withdrawals from their thing, they do a set amount with LNURL withdrawal. So you just get the link and then you go paste it into your Lightning wallet. Phoenix is the one that I'm usually withdrawing to. I paste it in Phoenix and it literally just pulls the payment from Fountain. So I can just kind of hang on to that. And whenever I need it, like somebody could literally give it to me and like email it to me or something. And whenever the hell I needed to, I just go grab the link and then just yanks the payment and it's got an explicit amount. And there's some interesting things there. Is like, how could you build a subscription from that? Granted, there's probably going to be easier tools when we get things like PTLCs and then Bolt 12, where you can have even more clear subscription models. But a LNURL type thing could be really interesting for like you issuing an LNURL from your own wallet to pay for a subscription for a service or something, and it would literally just try to pull payment. But I think, actually, technically, if you're using like a mobile wallet, that runs into the same problem because you have to be online to send the payment. So it'd be like a notification. It's like, oh, your monthly payment for Nostr.build or Stacker News Pro or whatever, Domus Purple is due. So yeah, you'd still have to open it up, so it wouldn't change a whole lot. But granted, like the notification model is also at least an improvement on the UX for managing something like that. And you know, I'm also really curious about how this is also one of the reasons why I'm so fascinated and digging into Pair runtime and the things that they're doing over with Keet and Hole Punch is because I can't help but, and I know this is a security trade-off. If you have your keys in multiple places. But it would be really interesting to have a Lightning wallet that is encrypted, and maybe even you could give a specific degree of signing power, kind of like how you do with Nostr and Insect Bunker. For those of you who don't know, one of the fascinating things about Nostr is that because it's a key-based system, you can have a one instance that's basically like your main instance, and it actually holds the private key. So it's the only one that can actually sign anything. But then you can give subkeys to like your MacBook, your mobile phone, and even to every single app. So I can give a subkey to Primal, I can give a subkey to Domus, I can give a subkey to Nostr Strudel, each one could, I can have different permissions. So like I could use this for team building out a team and other people posting to my Nostr account, like my producer. Like I would love to be able to just grant like kind one notes that he can post so that he can upload a video, like one of the little video promos or whatever that we build for the episodes of the show. And then he could automatically post it to my Nostr account and I didn't have to be there. But what's interesting about this is that this is all done on the key side. This is all just done with normal communication between these devices, and the one holding the private keys is basically just, it just has a policy where this subkey is simply only allowed to sign for this stuff. It just has these permissions. So it's kind of like you're running your own little web server that has admin control, and then you give granular control to any individual device. Now, the really cool thing about Pair Runtime is that you could basically create a encrypted, I mean, everything, every time you make connections between your devices or whatever, it's default end-to-end encrypted because every single device has a key. And you could also, I wonder if you could have a system where all of these devices could sign even without the other ones online, but maybe some of them only had granular control. I don't, you'd have to do that with the keys. Well, you can obviously do the insect bunker style sort of thing where you have like a main instance, but that still requires that instance to be online. So let's say we accept the security trade-off of having the same keys on three different devices for a Lightning wallet. Well, you could have your phone, your MacBook, and like, let's say my Linux machine. So I've got my phone, my laptop, and my Linux machine all with a encrypted tunnels that are all sharing Lightning updates. They're all watchtowers for each other, and they can all sign for new transactions. And what happens when somebody makes a request or is sending a payment to me or something is that it pings out to my little swarm, and it just automatically, one of them picks it up and signs it, and then notifies to the others that it's been signed. So if my mobile is offline, my MacBook can sign. If my MacBook is closed and my mobile is asleep, my Linux machine can sign. Like, I still think we can't discount how powerful these additional protocols in essentially decentralizing another layer of communication, how unbelievably beneficial just that sort of coordination is, especially when you start talking about like things like CISA, which is cross-input signature aggregation, which is a fancy way of saying you can just add signatures together, so not everybody has to be online to sign at the exact same time. So, like, let's say I and my brother and a friend of ours are all connected to a little pool with my Linux machine. And in a normal 404 multisig, basically you have to pass this around and everybody has to sign it. And the order and ways in which it's signed and then sent to the next person to get another signature is actually different. So there's a lot of limitations in exactly how you can make that coordination, and everybody basically has to be online at the same time where you send a PSBT to them and then they sign until you get like a threshold of signatures. But the interesting thing with something like CISA is not only are you able to combine all these signatures into one, but as I understand it, you're functionally just adding the signatures together to get the proper signature to basically unlock the coins or prove ownership. So what you get the benefit of is that nobody actually has to be online at the exact same time. Somebody can come online and sign and then, you know, leave it to, like, with something that Pair does. If you haven't listened to the Pair episode, God, I'm going to have to link to that one too. All right, Pair Runtime episode, the chat that we just had. Definitely listen to this if you have not explored or heard about this technology yet. And one of the things that they do is blind forward. So essentially the network can hang on to that signature while, let's say you come online and you sign a transaction and then you go offline. And then any one of my peers that I've been connected to in the past is going to grab that signature and hold it encrypted in this blind batch and this blind cache sort of thing that they just forward whenever somebody comes on to request it, and then they send it to me, and then I add my signature to it, and then it gets put out in the network again, or my Linux machine is just online, then our friend comes on, then my brother comes on, and each time they can just add to their signature, and now we can coordinate a 404 in which nobody is actually ever online at the same time, but we can actually still exchange this information, get it from one device to another in an entirely encrypted peer-to-peer fashion, like a live BitTorrent, web torrent. And it could create really interesting capabilities for something like a channel pool or something where, let's say you've got 20 people, 50 people. The problem with setups like those is the coordination problem, is how do you get everybody online? How do you get everybody signing the next update? You know, what if somebody doesn't show back up? Then you basically have to have fail safes or backups or, you know, that sort of thing. It just becomes the bigger you go, the bigger the coordination problem is. So technologies and new networks and new protocols, purely in the realm of communication, purely in the realm of like coming up with easier ways to make reliable online services or distribute online services and kind of peer-to-peer, multiple devices all serve the same purpose. In those sorts of fashions may actually be the thing that not only helps to make that sort of coordination possible, but maybe changes the dynamic of being online at all. Like maybe it's a physical technology. Maybe it's a literal communication technology, as in the fact that we find new signals data or a new signal innovation. Like think about how difficult Bitcoin would have been and how small Bitcoin necessarily would have been before smartphones. Think about how many things that we have that are capable, like things that we can do now, VR, AR, or personal assistant taking down reminders, like any of that sort of thing, or, you know, LLMs. Like think of what is possible with these technologies that is not possible without. And realize that some of Bitcoin's limitations, some of Lightning's limitations, may actually have more to do, have a better solution in a realm that's actually not, it's not even a change to Lightning. It's something entirely adjacent to the very concept of the communication. So anyway, now I'm just rambling, but it's just interesting to think about, because so many of these things feed back on each other. And what we really have that I think is genuinely game-changing is a permissionless ecosystem to try to just test all this stuff out, to build LNURL, to build the Breeze SDK, to try out eCash, to have anybody that you know that is technically viable or technically capable and that you trust to build out and run a service that, like, I like me and my brother could be an LSP. Like, think about how crazy that is. I don't have to get a license. I don't have to ask permission. I'm not even custodying anybody's money. I'm literally running a connection service for other people. And I think when you have that, it's like the internet. It's having a permissionless way to solve any communication problem, to be a journalist, to be a content creator, to have a global network and a global reach, is when you have that, when you have something like that in the internet, it's like 20 years later, Bitcoin is invented. And it's because Satoshi, the cypherpunks, the cryptographers, nobody had to ask the internet service provider if they could try. Nobody had to call up to get a license to run a new type of communication protocol, to set up their own network, to operate a piece of software. Satoshi ran it by himself, and Hal Finney, that could have been anywhere in the world, halfway around the world, can download it and run it and participate as well, because you have an open, permissionless communications platform to build on top of. The internet is going to be saved from its era of centralization because of Bitcoin and because of its permissionless nature. We can always solve its problem. Bitcoin just did that for money and finance the world over. We have no idea to what degree what is going to come of this and just how much impact it's going to have. We are just getting started. And every single day, we are moving closer to that future where everyone can be sovereign, everyone has private, permissionless payments, and the state monopoly over money has been relegated to the pages of history. As Roy said towards the beginning of this article and linked to the hilarious and great Louis C.K. interview that everything is amazing and no one is happy. Be happy. We are winning so hard. All right. I hope you guys enjoyed that read and commentary after. Do not forget to subscribe. Don't forget to share this show out. That makes a huge difference, and it is muchos, muchos appreciated. Seriously, you guys are the entirety of my marketing department, and I know you work for free, but I really appreciate your volunteer efforts to spread this show around and let people know that they need to be listening to Bitcoin Audible. And I've been talking to a lot of new people lately. Don't forget about the basics episodes. In fact, I will have the link in the show notes to that as well. I have a playlist on which I right now the playlist is actually on Spotify, but I haven't explored that. I wonder if I can do that on Fountain. I should check that out. But I will have the link to the playlist in the show notes. If you have anybody who is interested or starting to go down the Bitcoin rabbit hole and wants to begin their journey and just kind of wants to understand what the hell this thing is and how it works, that is why I have the Bitcoin Basics episode and why I started it with the episode, what is it? Like Bitcoin, what the hell is this thing? So share that out if you have someone that you think is ready and is starting to show interest again, because this is the time to kind of to ramp that up a little bit. So thank you guys for doing that. Thank you for subscribing. We've got some amazing episodes coming up. A conversation on AI Unchained is happening this Thursday. I guess that'll probably be tomorrow for the day that this comes out. Is with MVK of CoinKite. And CoinKite is also sponsoring this show, but that's not why I had him on. AI Unchained is because they have built, he and their team have built Unleashed.chat. And I actually found out there's a couple interesting things that it can do that I did not know about. And this is amazing that a legitimate and extremely useful competitor to something like ChatGPT can be built at this scale. And if you are interested in that and the AI stuff, you have got to listen to this episode. You're really going to enjoy this, and you should also try out Unleashed.chat. Lastly, a shout out to CoinKite for sponsoring the show, and then to Swan Bitcoin for sponsoring as well. Don't forget, links, discount codes will be in the show notes. 10% off your cold card with code BitcoinAudible. I love you all. Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to boost, drop a comment on Fountain, and I will catch you on the next episode. I'm Guy Swan, and until then, everybody, take it easy, guys. We can complain because rose bushes have thorns, or rejoice because thorns have roses. Alphonse Carr.